Yeah, me and Rob caught up with a cool guy called Kelly Bradley, who's recently been really engaged with all the circularity stuff. He's a guy who struggled with addiction in the past and found a way out and a journey through using something called Smart Recovery. So what's it about, dude?
Smart in itself is an acronym for self-management and recovery training. It is and it isn't an alternative to 12-step programs. It's an adjunct as well as an alternative. Some people can't get on with it, so it's a viable alternative. And it's a secular program, meaning that it's not faith-based, it's science-based and backed up with research, and is evolving with all the current research all the time. We're incorporating new tools all the time. And that's what it is. It's a toolbox, really, for people who want to be proactive about managing their problems. And I'm not just talking about destructive problems, DOCs. People interchange that with drug of choice and destruction of choice, because there are lots of people who come and for help with eating, overeating. I mean, it's an abstinence program. You know, that's the aim. Obviously, you can't abstain from food, but the abstinence side is, I guess, abstain from what is destructive about your eating, gambling, drinking, sex, porn. I could go on. I mean, how many destructive behaviours are there in the human psyche? I don't know. How long we got?
Depends what you take to the extreme as well. Mentioned in the conversations about obsessive behaviour, that kind of, to a point, become then destructive to relationships, to yourself.
Yeah, very much so. And even that's a choice. And it's hard to accept. It is a choice, you know. These things can be managed. Might take a lot of effort. Ultimately, it's worthwhile if you want to live a balanced and content life. I'm not aiming for happy. I'm aiming for content, you know.
So you kind of run, or facilitate, should I say, not run, but you kind of, you know, run online the meetings. They happen online, right? They're a digital kind of connection with people.
They are, and they're also face-to-face groups. Unfortunately, there isn't one in this area. There used to be at the CVS in Swadlincote.
Is that due to a lack of location, or is that just
lack of awareness, I think? Because the media focus a lot on other recovery programs and don't talk about science ones. I don't know why that is. That's an interesting question.
Establishment, isn't it? It's one of those things. If it has been within the cultural psyche, it tends to sit there and grows, and it's stuck there. You always think, when you think addiction, you think of
AA or NA or 12 steps. You're right. You're absolutely right. I know somebody who's recovered using that way, therefore that's the best way. The self-management and recovery training is what SMART really is. That's the essence of it. And for me, it's the self-management comes before anything, and that's for anything. Unless you can manage yourself in terms of your thoughts, your feelings and your behaviours, and the balance in your life, then you can't recover. So the four points within SMART are building and maintaining motivation, and coping with urges, managing thoughts, feelings and behaviours, and living a balanced life. And they're not steps. Each of these four points have tools relevant to them that we use. And these tools are based on cognitive behavioural therapy and rational emotive behavioural therapy. And they're proactive tools. And people within SMART have been you know, I'm not a facilitator, actually, because I'm not able to yet. You have to be a year in sobriety. But I've done the training, and they've asked me very kindly to be a permanent volunteer. So I co-facilitate. I do the help with the meetings online. But yeah, that's my goal, is to have to facilitate a Smart Recovery meeting. But people have been in recovery for a long time who come to Smart come anyway, because they use these tools for life. You take the destructive behaviour out of the equation, these tools work for everyday life, for every situation that you've got coming that is potentially challenging, and yeah, extremely helpful for all issues, I think, of the modern lifestyles.
I think the idea of being like addicted to something is historically to do with substance, but
yeah,
you know, it's behaviours, it's attitudes, it's actions, it's anything that is destructive in nature, basically. Yeah. Is something that you could form an addictive relationship to.
Absolutely, and for me, you just hit on exactly what I think there, in that what came first for me, before anything else, was my habitual way of thinking, my addiction to feeling and thinking in the way I always have. Some might say it's because of a traumatic event. I take that out now. I accept that it might have exacerbated the way my mind has gone, and the way I've. But I chose to be in that position because it was familiar and it was safer. However traumatic and destructive, it was safer. There was no risks involved in terms of feeling inadequate, and there was never any that feeling of being able to blame, that idea of I can blame what my environment, my peers, my situation, my if only this had happened then I would be earning more money, if only so and so had done this to me I would be, you know, all of that nonsense was an addictive way of thinking, and that led to everything. You know, it led to me being depressed about the world, being anxious in situations, being having to rely on substances to be able to survive in any social groups, you know. And
you're a clever bloke. When I met you earlier on in the week and I met you for the first time, the first essence that I got was like, you kind of know what you're doing, you know what you're talking about, and you know, you've got some knowledge. And some of the things we're talking about was to do with kind of your interest in biology and science and all that sort of stuff. So,
yeah, I wouldn't say clever. I'd say inquisitive, to the point of obsession at times. Which, yeah, so it's a double-edged sword. I mean, I didn't achieve very much at school. I had a bit of a rubbish time at school. Mental health wasn't really an issue then, you know, and there was no real such thing as therapy or dealing with trauma, which there was in my past. We moved around a lot as kids, and do you know, I've been guilty of using that as an excuse for my psyche, I suppose, my personality and flaws in thinking. I read about this study on military families that were moved around, had lots of different places where they grew up and schools they went to, and then they did this, you know, it was a long-term study, they went back to it them years later and see how they were getting on and the effect of this disruption in, I guess, you know, they're having to change, try and make new friends and all of that social. But yeah, they'd all struggled, basically. They'd all had problems throughout their life. From that that person telling me, well, go and find out for yourself. And it was a teacher, one of very few teachers that were positive influence on me. In that, you know, he recognised something in me, and he recognised maybe that I learned things differently at a different rate, or with peers, I was better at working stuff out in my own ways, and he gave me sort of free rein to do that. He allowed me to get away with stuff that the other teachers, I didn't do coursework very often. I didn't do what was asked of me. I came to lessons and without a folder and didn't take notes, and but I was always interested, and I always asked him a barrage of questions, and he sort of accepted that and let me get away with it. And I, in effect, that's all I left school with was a B in biology and a B in chemistry and a C in English, and that was it. I didn't turn up for anything else. I didn't bother with anything else because A, I didn't get on well with the teachers, and always had a mouth on me, which always got me into trouble because I've never been able to accept what I felt was injustice. Does that make sense? You know, and we all have to. I realise you have to, to some degree, we have to conform to what society demands of us, I guess, to be able to contribute to that society. Or at least, if you do object, there's a right way and a wrong way, and I clearly was choosing the wrong way because it was detrimental to me and others around me, you know. So, yeah, after school, I was like, oh, now what do I do? And did a YTS in building and ended up in London working away most of the week, and worked in... I was a little kid, as tiny as 16, dead small, and, working with all these area roofers, and their day, typical day, was up at R5, big fry up, work from 7 till 7, straight in the pub, eat, drink, and repeat. So I suppose that's where started to. For a confidence thing and to be able to socialise, I've always sort of, it was like, you know, have a drink before youth club at school, you know, all of that, and it just became, well, if I want to get by, if I want to have confidence, then this helps, this really works, you know, I can be what people want me to be while I'm drinking. But it was kind of normal, you know. Well, I was in an environment at a young age where it was just normal, you know. And I never thought of it as a problem or as an issue. It was just part of life. But yeah, that soon became intolerable. So I found myself back at home and nothing to do. Got a phone call out of the blue from the place I did work experience with in the fourth year. Actually set up by this... aforementioned teacher, and I really got on well there. Yeah, they ran me out of the blue and offered me a job. Wow. It was like one of them, wow, where did that come from, you know? We've got this place making media, so basically making agar for petri dishes,
yeah.
Pouring them for a food microbiology lab in Overseal. It's not there anymore. And I kept asking questions, and why do we do this? What's this for? And they got a bit fed up with that, so they said, well, why don't you go to college? And I said, well, I can't, I haven't got the qualifications. So they said, right, all right, we'll get you through. I was doing everything I wanted to do, working, enjoying work, getting paid quite well, which all went on going out Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday. I had a friend there who worked for Bass. He had his Bass card, so we just, college was a drinking day, you know, so interspersed with the odd lecture, some of which we had in the dog. Got playing music, got into the odd band, and work was going really well. They wanted to, the managers of the labs wanted to set up their own company, which they did, and they wanted me to come and help, and actually gave me free rein to help design the media preparation part of the lab, which was great, because I had it just how I wanted it, and it ran really efficiently, and they said, right, okay, what's next? And I was like, oh god, I've got to do more. So they sent me back and did a HNC, did all that, got married, had kids. To be able to function, I was drinking heavily, but it was high functioning, would you call it? Well, people, that's what they say, they a functional person with a problem with alcohol. I was functioning. I wasn't aware that it was a problem, which I think is common. It's insidious, how it creeps. Any destructive habitual behaviour is like that, I think, until it crosses the threshold where you become physically, emotionally dependent on that, whatever substance or whatever behaviour. I'm not going to distinguish between chemicals and behaviour, because I don't really see that there is much of one. Gambling, sex, they're all chemical in nature, I guess, when you come back to the what happens in your brain.
I think there was something that, just to pick up on, was the fact that you said that it was normal. And I was thinking back to mine and your days in college, Rob. You know, like Thursday, Friday, Saturday, I can relate to that. That's what we did.
Went out on a Friday down to the refinery. Went out on a Saturday down to the refinery. Rock night one night, dance night the next night.
That was a lifestyle. That was a normal existence. That was what we all did, you know. And the same is like, as you say, you know, when we were at college, we popped off at lunch for a pint and that. And yeah, that's kind of what happened. That was quite normal. That was part of the environment that we were in, I suppose. And I think something interesting that you said was that, like, there was a threshold, and like, what is that? What is that threshold?
I'm glad you picked up on that, because, what is that threshold? For me, it was, I think, the first secretive drink was the threshold for me. You know, once I crossed that line into drinking that only I knew about, all the getting in from work, whoever got home first had the spliff ready and the cans or whatever in the, you know, all of that stopped, and the wine every night when the kids came along, but it didn't for me, you know. So I was, you know, by this time I was doing my degree at Nottingham, and I was in the band, and I'd got the kids, I'd gone into a new job because I got made redundant, and I was in a managerial role, middle management, which I hated. It wasn't, I always seemed to end up being in that role because I think I enjoyed negotiating, and I think that always put me in that role. But I hated, because you got shit from above and shit from below, you know. And that was really stressful. So I had all of this going on, but I was managing because I was able to just keep topping myself up. And I think, like I said to you, I mean, my final exams and my degree were done on 3/4 of a bottle of vodka. And I, you know, there were days, I've always struggled with depression and anxiety from an early age. So, you know, I was self-medicating, I like to say. Lots of people like to say that, don't they? But there's truth in it. But I was also taking antidepressants and anti-anxiety meds, and swapping and changing them, and not taking them and taking them, and all of that stuff that you do, I think, because you get sick of the side effects, and, you know, they're not working anyway if you're drinking heavily. And so I had all of this going on, and it just came to the point where I wasn't able to function at all without a drink. You know, I had to have a drink to get through anything, any social event. And then, like I say, it was the secretive side of things that became the top of the slippery slope for me, because that's when the behaviour aspect, that it wasn't just the addictive nature of the substance, it was that planning involved of when am I going to get it, how am I going to do it without anybody knowing. And there was almost some thrill in that as well. I pulled the wool over their eyes again, nobody knows. Of course they do. So in smart recovery, there are stages of change: pre-contemplation, contemplation, action, maintenance, and then, different to other programs, there's termination, I hate that word, graduation, I like to say, or exit. Yeah. And relapse and lapse is just is a not a necessary part, but it's, and in smart recovery and other programs, it's seen as a learning opportunity rather than a, oh, that's it, I can't do it, I've got to give in. Which, I've seen many, many people do and lost many, many friends that way. Realised it, I was definitely in the contemplation stage, this is really a problem, my relationship's suffering badly. At the time, I was working in a brewery as well, and I'd finished my degree, I was doing a diploma in brewing. I was working at Marston's at the time in the lab, working with yeast cultivation, and loved it. Money was crap, but I loved the job. And then moved to Molson Coors for 100% pay rise. I mean, why wouldn't you? In retrospect, in hindsight, I look back and think it was one of the worst decisions I made. You went from a job I loved and got a lot of satisfaction from, to one I in a role that I wasn't happy in again. I was in a role where I was implementing health and safety and 5S, which is the Japanese thing that the company bought. And basically everything was changing, and I was walking around with a clipboard telling people who'd done the jobs, man and boy, you can't do that anymore. Doesn't go down very well. So yeah, the problem got worse and worse. And well, I always had this idea in my mind from growing up. I was always told by family and peers that, and teachers, I guess, that, and there was this thing about man's got to be the breadwinner and man's got to do this. Man's got to provide for the family and always got to have more money and stability. And for me, it was the detriment to my life and my relationship. And as a father, I believe I was, when I was present and I was reasonably sober, I was a good father, I like to think. But I also know that there were times when I was despicable. It's something I've let go of now. I don't dwell on it. I see it as it's the past. If I go on to other programs, the focus is very much on owning what's happened in the past and what you've done, and admitting that you became powerless. And I've always balked at that. I've never thought I'm powerless. There's always thought that it's been in my power. I chose wrongly. It always comes down to a choice. Whatever mitigating factors, whatever hardships, whatever trauma, got to be brutally honest with myself. It was a choice. It's my choice. I struggled with conventional recovery programs, like 12-step programs. The first step is to admit powerlessness, and that I just could never get over that. I could never get over the idea of that. I thought, well, what's the point? Because I've never believed in God per se or higher power. It's not to say that I don't respect people who do or respect spirituality. I believe I have my own version, but I'm certainly not reliant on it. I think that's dangerous to rely on anything I don't really see much of a distinction in relying on a higher power to relying on another form of support, be that chemical or behavioural. So this idea really, really struck me, and there was always this advice, you know, because at that point I was firmly in, to use the smart reasoning, I was firmly in the action stage of change, trying to find whatever I could. I split from my wife, and things just went down and well, very, very quickly then. Lost my job through drinking at work. I got so many chances given to me. So many people turning blind eyes, so many like I say, lots and lots of help. I can't
Would you deem that now, looking back, as being help though, by turning a blind eye rather than confronting the issue with you?
Good question, very good. No, it wasn't helpful. It was enablement, really. Definitely. You know, I put people's lives at risk every day. You know, we're working with machinery. It's not something I'm proud of course, and I do regret it, but it's not where my focus is now. But yeah, you're absolutely right. It wasn't help. I suppose the help came when I admitted to them I had a problem, and they did offer help and support in terms of counselling and you know, recommending 12-step groups, because that's kind of all that the industry and local health authorities kind of recognised as the only way to recovery was this kind of.
I think that's the one most people are aware of. That'd be the one that's in all the TV shows. It's everywhere. Is AA, Alcoholics Anonymous, for one, Drugs Anonymous, or essentially something anonymous, and then 12 steps. And as you say, the admitting the powerlessness was something I hadn't fully thought through. In that first step, is you've got to admit you were powerless against that. Now, we've mentioned on a few podcasts when you had started talking about choice. I'm a very big support of the idea that everything is a choice. I like choice theory as a way, because we all have a choice, maybe not to something that can happen to us, but how we react to it.
Very good point. Yeah, and that's something that resonated with me when I first heard somebody say that, and they quoted some clever guy from ancient Greeks, or I don't know, a long time ago. I could tell you, I could look it up now, but you know, people can look up themselves, and I think that's information's everywhere, isn't it? And it's accessible to people that want it, and I think that's the key. If you want it, then you'll find it, and it'll work better for you, in my opinion.
Yeah, it's really interesting, because it's that 12-step thing was like the Russell Brand recent book that he did based around it that I'd listened to on as an audio book, you know.
And yeah, I've listened myself.
Yeah, it was great. It was really interesting. But I was listening to that the you know, the handing the power over thing and the submission, you know, kind of to a bigger entity than yourself. Now, I suppose if you're calling that the universe or whatever you want, then you could kind of go there if you're that way inclined in terms of a spiritualness, you know. But
it all stems from a Christian ideal, doesn't it?
Yeah,
where it was set up from was originally.
Yeah,
it is a faith-based program. You can't get away from that. And they do say higher power of your choice, and that's all well and good. But they still read from the same book that uses the word God, and they say God of your own choosing. It's still this handing over, admitting powerlessness, and then of course what I've seen happen is when people inevitably lapse or relapse, press the fuck it button. Well, I've been let down by this higher power. The universe has let me down, as if we deserve better from the universe. When really, to my mind, we're connected by contribution. We're not by expecting to be treated in a special way, you know.
When you started explaining that a bit more, as in that self, handing yourself over, it's kind of like saying, well, I have this problem, but this problem isn't my fault.
Yeah.
And I get the thought process behind that, and not having been addicted to alcohol or drugs or anything like that. On the other side, I'm sitting there going, we've talked about on here. When we first started these, I was going to the gym 3 times a week to try and lose weight. I'm still where I was when I was still going to the gym there. But the choice is, do I sit at home or go to the gym? And I know what the right choice is. It's not the choice I make. Then the fact that I haven't lost any weight is then because of my choices. It's not because if I then go, well, I'm addicted to food and the way I'm living at the minute, I've got to hand over that and say that that's not my fault. I can't really say that because I've chosen to do the things that have got me to this position.
But it's a tricky one there, because it leads to the idea of this medical model of, do you know what? I keep trying to avoid the word addiction, but I can't, you know, cause, I mean, I just don't like it. It's got the word "a dick" in it, you know. Well, and any, I mean, in Smart we use DOC. We use a lot of acronyms. A destruction of choice. People say drug of choice. I prefer destruction of choice, because it, ultimately that's what we're there for, is to stop being destructive. And my destruction of choice has been alcohol, amongst other things, and food, and isolation, and but it all comes back to a mental health issue to me, rather than I've heard these people say a moral deficiency or a spiritual malady. I can't accept any of those things. Because I don't believe there's anything, truly anything, that we can't change. Even if it's a small way. To me, the actual acceptance in itself, once I accept something, I've changed. So yeah, acceptance, I like to flip it around as well and say, yeah, okay, accept the things I cannot change now, but also change the things that I cannot accept. My last drink ended me in hospital. After a few seizures, I had a brain scan. Long story short, I had quite a lot of really, really positive things happen in hospital, and some really, really negative ones. I couldn't fault the healthcare assistants and the nurses at all, and many of the doctors. The problem I had was I had lots of different consultants, and they all told me different things. One said, well, we're going to help you through this. We're going to, you know, you're going to be here at least a week. You know, I had major, major withdrawal problems, and being given Librium's, but it's chlordiazepoxide, but it's a benzodiazepine that helps with withdrawals. So I was on quite a high dose of that. So one day they were telling me, right, we're upping your dose because you're really struggling still, the sweats, the shakes, all of that that comes with it. And you're on PRN. So basically when I was struggling, I could ask for more. And then the next day it was, right, we're lowering your dose. I was told yesterday you're increasing it. So I had that. I had one saying you're going to be here at least a week, and the next day you'll be leaving today. Still on quite a high dose of chlordiazepoxide. So basically I was told by the consultant, right, you need to go to Back O'Connor, which is a very, really successful and highly respected rehab in Burton, and it's kind of made famous as well by Russell Brand's program, because he visited there, and so they run a 12-step program there, and I'm really impressed with its success and everything. That's great, you know, and people work these programs and they do succeed. Many, 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 many don't. My alternative was, you go there, or there's no alternative. I mean, this time I'd been working as a volunteer in Smart Recovery for quite a while, and I'd been sober for quite a while. Still had every hope that I using the SMART program, it got me through the days in hospital of feeling like death. SMART recovery and all its tools and all my successes within it got me through, you know. And the idea of a lapse is just a bump in the road, or, you know, it's part of the journey to learn from. I mean, you don't, if you're traveling from A to B on a long journey in your car and you have a puncture or it breaks down, you don't leave the car there and or just stay in that location forever or give up on your journey completely. You fix whatever the problem is, you learn from it. So I explained this to the consultant. Oh, you know, this is what I'm doing with Smart Recovery. He'd never heard of it. What is this Smart Recovery? So I explained. I said, well, it's basically based on CBT and REBT, which is Rational Emotive Behavioural Therapy, which are all widely used within the NHS. Yet programs that use these tools that have been proven to use in mental health issues, which I believe habitual destructive behaviour, addiction, is a mental health issue. It's widely used and widely accepted, yet it's not the go-to, certainly in this area. It's not accepted as part of recovery for addicts. So I explained all this, you know, you either go to Back O'Connor, which I just didn't want to do. I've been in rehab before. I did 6 months in Plymouth, and I was lucky enough to go to a rehab there in Plymouth that was CBT based and dual diagnosis. So you were given your medication, your antidepressants or whatever you needed for whatever mental health issue you were dealing with. I know of other rehabs where they won't do that. They want you off every substance. I wasn't prepared to go there. With me still being on a high dose of Librium, he was like, well, you will go home and you will start to withdraw again. So my advice, if you're not going to go there, my advice to you is just have a little drink. have a little drink, but just have a little drink to stave off the withdrawals. And then later on, if you start to withdraw again, have another little bit drink, but then reduce. And I'm like, I can't fucking do that. And I'm not that kind of drinker. I've never been... I was binge, you know, it was all or nothing. I open a bottle, it's gone. I was that kind of drinker. I tried to explain this and he's like, well, no, you'll struggle otherwise. So from going thinking I'm going to be here and they're going to get me through these withdrawals through the medication the way that it's advisable, being told that I was going to be there to told I'm going home and to have a drink, no less. So I was fuming. I didn't do that. I'm not furious about it anymore. I'm still righteously indignant, I think, about it, and worried about the situation.
But if that's the advice from a doctor, regardless of whether they think that's a medical condition or a mental health condition, advising somebody who can't regulate the intake of a substance to go and try to have a little bit of that substance... It's like saying to a cat, go and chase like one mouse. Don't kill the rest of the mice.
Yeah, yeah.
It's interesting. There's Johan Hari. Are you familiar with that? You obviously are, sorry. I just think that guy's a legend with what he's up to. And both himself and Russell Brand have gone down this kind of idea of our understanding of addiction is wrong. And the stigma that's attached to addiction is just nonsensical. It's kind of sensationalised through media. And I'd hope that anyone listening to this would be like, actually, no, this is like, there's real stories here. And the thing that both of those guys have said about the notion of addiction is that it is often down to loneliness, isolation, or a lack of connection. That seems to be a common trait. I'm also a big fan of Blind Boy, who I never mention.
But Johan Hari's last TED Talk is about addiction. The opposite of addiction is connection.
The change from being inactive addiction and to getting better. And that's the whole point of SMART and using the tools, is you can get better. It is, you know, you can recover and you can exit. You don't have to be an addict for your entire life. I mean, this might sound shocking, but actually being an addict is a learned skill, but it is a development, like any other development. Your brain develops and you develop into this habitual way of getting your reward, and it becomes the point where nothing else gives you any pleasure, and even that destruction of choice gives you no pleasure. But before that, the first stage that you're in, I guess, is it's described as the pre-contemplation stage. So you're not even thinking about stopping. It's not even on your radar. You know, other people are telling you you've got a problem, you know, and you're just shrugging it off and thinking, no, I'm okay. I'm sure there are lots of people who perhaps identify with feeling that way. And then gradually you kind of phase into this contemplation where you think, well, maybe, you know, things should be better. I could be better. My life could be better, or more like I want it. I'd rather it be. So from contemplation, you maybe start thinking, well, what can I do about this? So you go out looking for help. And unfortunately, up until kind of recently, there was only sort of one model of the idea of being able to get help, and that was perhaps the 12-step model and the idea of addiction as a disease. So from contemplation, yeah, you look at the you look at what's out there to get help. So you start preparing, you go to meetings, you do some research, and you talk to friends and peers and anybody, you know, your GP, anybody's really sort of interested in helping you. And for me, SMART was the one that resonated with me so much, because it gave me the choice back. It gave me the power back. It was telling me that I had the power, which made me feel strong, and you know, that's what's needed through the two stages of change, I believe. So from preparation, you'll take action, you start going to meetings, and maybe you'll stay in that stage for quite a while, where you're having to go, or you're choosing to go to lots of meetings because you're in early recovery and it's hard. There's lots of triggers out there that create the urges and the cravings that are full on. But eventually they get less and less. The more you deny them, the more you create new pathways in your brain and new reward systems. Your brain will never return to how it was, but you will build new pathways and strong pathways if you stick to them. So they, yeah, and then you get into maintenance, which I truly believe I am in the maintenance stage now. I go to meetings that I can, I help meetings I can, but I don't feel that if I don't go to a meeting, I'm going to have trouble. That's not to say I'm complacent. With this, the slide that's used, it's the term's used termination, which is sounds a bit awful to me. I think graduation's perhaps better, or exit. And within that cycle, if you imagine it as a cycle, there's relapse, not inevitably but very, very, very commonly. And within the SMART program and the SMART ethos, it's the idea that relapse is optional, of course, but it should never be seen as a reason for a complete relapse rather than a lapse. And we like to think if you can twist it and use it as a learning opportunity, you can then go from relapse straight back into action, taking action again, and then you're back in maintenance. And it's not advisable, but it's not something to beat yourself up about.
So you've got those stages and those processes.
Yeah.
Like, how does a meeting happen? How does it take shape? Like, what parts of the meeting are there, and like who is involved? How does it run?
Okay, well, you've got trained facilitators, and that's all on the. There's training is open to anybody who wants to do it. You don't have to become a facilitator, but many people find that that is a really amazing aid to their own recovery, that feeling of being able to share your own experiences and success is an amazing opportunity. So yeah, volunteers that become facilitators through the smartrecovery.org.uk website, from there you can go on to the training. So yeah, the people volunteer, they become facilitators. Before that, they can become co-facilitators or helpers. So generally that's how the meetings are run. You have an introduction, and the guidelines are set at the beginning of the meeting. And the online platform is through Adobe Acrobat, which is nothing to worry about. It's very simple to use. Even I managed it. So the helper, once the guidelines have been set, the helper will run through the list of participants for the meeting, from top to bottom, or in any way they choose. People have started to vary it to have some spice, I guess. They've started from the bottom and gone up, and which has been quite interesting for the people who have. You choose your own pseudonym, let's say, or if you're me, you just call yourself your name. So people are like, "Oh, I don't want to check in first." So they'll call themselves Xylophone or whatever, you know. A few helpers, recent ones, have really threw the spanner in that work, which has been quite fun, throwing people off guard, but all in a fun way. So during the check-in, it's a chance for the participants to talk about what challenges they may have been having. It's not really a platform or an opportunity to go into the past and all the horror stories that we all have. It's not really about that, as opposed to perhaps other programs. It's more about how you're managing right now, and so yeah, any successes you've been having, what tools you may have been using, if you've been through Smart before or are using Smart. Yeah, so from the check-ins, while people are talking, the facilitator will be in the background scribbling away ideas of how what tools maybe we could go over in detail, which is really helpful for everyone, but in particular people new people to Smart who don't really know the tools that well, or don't really know how to apply them, or just really interested in seeing how other people use them. And once the agenda's set, we all sort of agree on whether that's the way forward or any more tools could be added. And then after all that, once the tools have been talked through and we've all had a good meeting, we all check out and go down or up the list again, and everybody says, "Yeah, it was great. This week I've got this to do and I'm going to use this tool." And then we all say goodbye, see you next meeting, and that's kind of how it works.
So just one question about that I've got. Okay. So it's not a question, it's a clarification really for me, which is, like, you've got the tools,
yeah,
and you've got the check-in and the kind of discussion around those. Does the facilitator map the tools to the notes they've made about the check-in?
They are facilitating in the true sense. They're not, it's not lecturing, it's not, they're just guiding really, through their experience. And lots of facilitators are use the tools just for general challenges throughout their life, you know. They're pretty much exited their addiction,
so they're more signposting. It's not dictatorial, it's not "you must do this is what you should do." It's more like,
absolutely not, no, it's definitely not dictatorial. It's definitely on a, you know, we all agree that this would be great. And yeah, the facilitator will then bring up slides around the tools so that people can see them visually, and or they've got the opportunity to write on a blank screen as well, do their own diagrams and things, but it's not just them talking and the participants listening. They often say, right, I'm just going to open the mic now for anybody who wants to perhaps add their take on this talk. HOV simply stands for Hierarchy of Values. And I thought, what the hell's all that about, you know? And when I was asked, this was a face-to-face workshop, and I was just in that sort of contemplation stage, when I need to do something about this, maybe. And then I was asked to write down things that are valuable to me in my life. And of course, family was up there, children, friends, relationships, job, all of those things. And I'm sure you could think of lots, as we all can. And then I was asked to sort of condense them down and put them in a hierarchy, which was really hard to do. But I did mine, you know, and I think children are at the top, and thought, yeah, that's it, that's definitely right, that's the way I see my life, that's the structure, that's where I put my attention. The guy said, well, where do you put your destruction of choice, your using, your drinking, your gambling, and of course none of us who were there doing it had put it down. It wasn't on the list, actually. You're putting that above all of those, and that was boom, hit me like a ton of bricks and a big sinking feeling in the stomach, and you know, all of that. And I had a choice then, it's just like feel all the guilt and the remorse and the shame and just carry on. People do, unfortunately, but I chose to think, well, that's just not on, it's not right, and I want to put something else at the top of my list. They cross out your drug of choice, your destruction of choice, or whatever it is, and put abstinence at the top, because it's an abstinence idea. The whole program doesn't really fit with the idea of maybe moderating. I'm not saying that that can't be done, but yeah, the whole ethos is around abstinence. So abstinence, really put that at the top, and then all your other values can be there. You know, you can be applying yourself to being true to all of those values. But for me, I couldn't be abstinent without sorting out my mental health. And so, and as I've said before, I see all destructive habitual behaviours as a mental health issue. So before I could become abstinent, I had to sort my mental health, which is sorting out my lifestyle balance, which is another big part of SMART.
We had this kind of idea inspired by kind of your thing that you wanted to try about having like a session called Circularity Sounds, and we're going to do that on Tuesday the 11th of June at the Gresley Old Hall. I suppose it's kind of weird, because I think to anyone who's been to circularity events before, particularly the ones that I've had the run of, they're probably coming in gone, I don't have a clue what's going on, it's like chaos, there's no plan. It's
my idea was, and I sort of working title, and it was Sound Insanity, because for me music has played a massive role, and playing music for me, it's helped so much. And confidence has always been an issue for me, and you know, I don't have my crutch of alcohol or any other substance to lean on, so I'm building confidence now, and just would love to be able to share all the stuff that I've gathered over the years, and just have people who maybe have not played for a while, or maybe lost confidence, or maybe just want to get back into the feeling of talking, and not just talking jamming through instruments, I'm talking jamming through conversation as well. you know, linking it back to, you know, I've been to a rehab, and one music therapy consisted of people coming along and talking about a certain song, and I thought, oh, I'm going to hate this. People coming along with songs that I thought, I don't know, I hate that song. But then my whole perception and my idea around that song was changed when I heard them talk so passionately about how what it meant to them, and I listened with a completely new ear. And anything that can open my mind and eyes and ears to new things is a wonderful thing for me, and I think for all of us. Why have this narrow when there's so much out there, so much variety? I just think there are maybe lots of people out there like myself who have bits and bobs of ideas, and maybe don't really know what they're doing, or maybe do know what they're doing, but have never really, you know, been able to or wanted to share. And it's all about a sharing experience for me, for sanity and for fun. So it's an opportunity for then people to maybe take stuff away and form little whatever. I envision sort of this fluid networking idea of people just contributing to new sounds, because they're only 12 notes, but there's a massive variety of putting them together, aren't they, you know? Well, in Western music,
I think that's the thing I'm most looking forward to with the night, is like trying instruments that I've not played before. I really enjoy doing that, because you kind of get locked into habits with music, don't you, sometimes, if you've got your thing that you do. And actually, you know, sometimes just picking up a new toy. So, like, yeah, I suppose, I mean, we put the event on Facebook and the Circularity groups, in the Circularity Foundation page, actually. That's the one that's hosting, and then we've got yourself with Sound Insanity and your concept, and then also Chris White with his Piggyback Studios.
Yeah,
it's kind of his room, really. He's like letting us borrow his space, and he's going to bring a few things like drums and that. He's going to do a talk about drums he was talking about. So, like, yeah, I mean, there's already people sort of signed up to come. I mean, we're kind of running the night for free, but like, I suppose what we'll probably end up doing is taking donations on the night, because obviously it's Chris's room and he pays for that. So we could maybe give him some money for helping us out. So if you can bring a couple of quid or whatever, if you're up for coming, and yeah, nip onto Circularity Foundation page on Facebook and then go into the events on there, and you'll see it, Circularity Sounds, and there's a quick overview on there and the date and the time and where it is and all that sort of stuff. And just send us like a message, or remember, you can like tweet us at circularity.org, or same on Instagram, message us on at circularity.org, or join one of the groups on Facebook. We've got the Circularity group, we've got the Circularity music group, and we've got the Circularity health group now. So you can hook up with us on any of those things. So yeah, we'll see as many of you on the night as we can.